not a sprain or an itch. Pain that's swelling a twitch. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
If he brings you happiness, then I wish you all the best. It's your happiness that matters most of all. But if he ever breaks your heart, if the teardrops ever start, I'll be there before the next teardrop falls.
That song was a rendition of Before the Next Teardrop Falls, originally by Freddie Fender, a Tex-Mex country singer. Most of his songs, and many other singers, especially country western singers, have a repertoire of sad songs that help make them famous. So why would anyone want to listen to a bunch of sad songs? Most of us probably never gave a thought to this. After all, it seems that everyone would or should rather listen to happy music rather than listen to a bunch of sad songs. How about taking a moment and thinking about some of your favorite songs? Are many of those actually of the sad song genre? I bet at least some are. So my question was, why?
Do we listen to sad songs to be sad? Sometimes sad songs do make you feel bad if they revive memories of your own tragic times. But more often, they engage your interest because they describe or convey important events in the lives of others.
This is the same emotional attachment that we may have when we partake of other art forms, such as painting or even listening or watching the tragic dramas, such as Shakespeare's Hamlet or seeing the paintings of Picasso's Guernica and watching thrilling but sad movies. I read an article about a theory called the semantic pointer theory, developed by Paul Thagard and Tobias Schroeder, which is used to explain the pleasure of engagement with intense negative emotions.
We are in no way trying to minimize how complicated the thinking and emotional process of the human being is in a 30-minute show. After all, we have 100 billion brain cells with close to a quadrillion connections between them, and we have yet to fully understand one single cell.
So emotions require brain processes that bind together three things. The first is representation of the situation. Secondly, we have perceptions of physiological changes that take place in response to that situation. And finally, understanding. For lack of a better word, in appraising the relevance of the situations to the ultimate goals. Now let's get back to the sad songs.
When you experience sad songs or an equivalent, such as tragic fiction, you may experience some of the same physiological reaction that occurs when you yourself are in a bad situation. But the cognitive appraisal is very different.
Why? Because the sad song, tragic drama, or horror movie is not actually about you, and therefore it's not a threat to your own goals. In fact, the realization that the current state of your life is not sad, tragic, or horrific can give you a feeling of relief and perhaps even happiness that you are not suffering in the same way that the singer or actor is. So the emotional engagement that the sad song provides usually comes without personal threat.
Don't take it personal. It's just my job.
Many of us have heard that the song Hey Jude by the Beatles has been reportedly about the sadness that John Lennon's son had concerning his parents' divorce.
But if you look at all of the words, and you can also see the hopeful and positive in providing the message that you can take a sad song and make it better, just like life. The first song in the show, Before the Next Teardrop Falls, tells the sad story, at least in the singer's eyes, when his girl leaves him for another man, but ends, well, by telling her that if she is left alone, she can come back to him. A hopeful statement.
Most of us have turned to melancholy music to make us feel better at some point in our lives, and this is the case of all musicians and music in all languages.
We've talked about the semantic pointer theory. Now let's focus on a new study which may shed light on what's going on inside our brains when we match our music to our feelings. And it looks like sad music can be enjoyable rather than simply depressing by triggering positive memories that can help to lift our mood and our spirits.
The study performed at the universities in both the United Kingdom and Finland covered 2,436 people in total and found that there was a wide spectrum of responses to this genre of songs.
But there were three key responses that stood out in particular, these being pleasure, comfort, and pain. Often these reactions were triggered by happy or sad memories recalled by the music.
Another psychologist, Adrian North from Curtin University in Australia, says that there are two possible reasons for why we enjoy listening to sad music. She says that in terms of social psychology, one way of thinking about this is that we feel better about ourselves if we focus on someone who's doing even worse.
That is simply called a downward social comparison. You know, like when someone says, "I was complaining of tight shoes until I saw someone who had no shoes at all." The second group of options is centered on neuroscience and the chemical processes actually going on inside our minds.
Some scientists think melancholy music is linked to the hormone prolactin, a chemical which helps to curb grief.
The body is essentially preparing itself to adapt to a traumatic event. And when that event doesn't happen, the body is left with a pleasurable mix of opiates with nowhere else to go.
We do know that listening to music does release dopamine, which our avid listeners all know is a neurotransmitter associated with food, sex, and drugs.
So at certain emotional peaks, we get pleasure from listening to sad tunes. Another hypothesis, though, suggests sadness is handled differently by our minds when we experience it through art rather than firsthand.
Research showed also that listeners often gravitate towards sad music because of its perceived beauty, and the greater aesthetic appeal of gloomy tunes was also noted in the new study from the UK and Finland.
That might link into the association between feeling miserable and creating iconic art. Some research points to a melancholy temperament leading to works of art that are more appealing to the extent that you can objectively judge art anyway. Arguably, sadness seems to make us more focused and diligent, which could affect listening to as well as creating music.
However, one fact still remains, and that is the fact that this pleasant sadness doesn't work the same way in everyone.
For some people, sad tunes were in fact distressing and negative, usually because of the bad memories they brought up. So don't always think that a great sad soundtrack may not always be the best way to cheer up a friend. How about we talk on histology, the science of cells? Well, that sounds boring enough, so how can we make this interesting, educational, as well as fun? Let's start.
Yes. How about blood? Blood could be considered an organ or a tissue, but it is definitely made up of cells, and the term histology is the study of cells.
It could be argued that blood is an organ because it is composed of different tissues, but it may also be called an organ since the definition of an organ is a group of different tissues coming together to perform a specific function.
Blood is one of the several members in the group of connected tissues. However, an organ is formed of multiple different tissues. Thus, many believe that blood is a tissue, not an organ.
But back to square one. While organs are generally considered to have a single specific function, or perhaps a group of closely related functions, blood, you know, the fluid inside the vessels, not the vessels themselves, have many different functions. For example, blood moves oxygen from lung to cells and removes waste by moving carbon dioxide from the cells to the lungs.
It also carries a whole bunch of nutrients to place it in the body that they are needed. Some of these are floating free on their journey to the destination, while others link to other molecules, just like some people use taxis and buses to get places.
In other words, nutrients carried to their destination cells attach to protein and fat particles. Blood also provides transport for the immune system and other waste products to liver and kidneys. Also, hormones and antibodies use the blood as their pathway to their ultimate goal, the organs and cells. Now, so far, we've only mentioned the blood as a pathway to move other important chemicals that are needed. But the blood also can regulate heat in the body and maintain the pH and water balance.
I see bones. I see gizzards and bones.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves. We said that we're going to talk histology, the study of cells. So let's begin with the cells that we see every day on our friends, our family, and ourselves.
Dr. Laske is talking about skin cells. Skin is the soft outer tissue covering of vertebrates with three main functions: protection, regulation, and sensation.
All mammals have some hair on their skins. Even marine mammals like whales, dolphins, and porpoises, which appear to be hairless. The skin interfaces with the environment, and it is the first line of defense from external factors.
For example, the skin plays a key role in protecting the body against dangerous germs and excessive water loss.
Its other functions are insulation, temperature, regulation, sensation, and the production of vitamin D folates. Severely damaged skin may heal by forming scar tissue. Now, anatomically, let's start at the top of the skin, that is. The outer layer is called the epidermis.
You gotta have skin. All you really need is skin. Skin's the thing that if you got it outside, it helps keep your insides in.
The skin is made up two general layers called the dermis and the epidermis, with the epidermis being the outer layer that is the one that everybody sees.
Even then, this layer can really be divided, as thin as it is, into what I would call sublayers, but the anatomists called stratum. Now, these include the corneum, granulosum, spinosum, and basal, with one added called the lucidum, only seen in the palms and soles. In the dermis is where the real work is done, as the only things of note in the epidermis are the sweat ducts.
You will find the sweat glands, sweat ducts, arteries, nerve, fat tissues, and Pacinian corpuscles, which are the nerve endings in the skin responsible for sensitivity to vibration and pressure.
We've talked about the epidermis and the dermis. There's a thin sheet of fiber called the basement membrane, which controls the traffic of the cells and molecules between the dermis and epidermis. Also serves as a reservoir for their controlled release during the repair processes that may be necessary. From the deep layers of the dermis come the hairs that start their growth in the hair follicles.
You may never have thought of it, but there are muscles in the skin itself. These include the arrector pili muscles that attach to each hair follicle.
When they tighten, it causes them to contract, thus causing those hairs to stand up straighter. In some animals, this is much more prominent than in humans. Now, hair itself is pretty interesting. Hair fibers have a structure consisting of several layers.
Starting from outside in, we have the cuticle, which actually consists of several layers of flat, thin cells laid out, overlapping one another just like roof shingles.
Below this is the cortex, and this contains keratin, which also makes up horns, claws, and hooves, though not in humans. Finally, we have the medulla, which is a disorganized and open area at the center of the hair.
The skin is the largest and most visible organ in the body, both in weight and its surface area, and separates the body's internal environment from the external environment.
The next group of tissues are part of the connective tissue group. We spoke a little about these on a recent show when we showed why the elderly have larger ears and noses than when they were younger. If you don't know why and would like to, go to our podcast and listen to one of our earlier shows. You can also go to our very own internet radio show at heydoc.podbean.com and listen to the shows there as well.
Connective tissue is one of the four basic tissue groups, along with the epithelial, muscle, and nervous tissue.
Where do you find it? Darn near everywhere in the human body. It's often found between other tissues, including the nervous system.
As a matter of fact, in the central nervous system, the three outer membranes called the meninges that envelop the brain and spinal cord are composed of connective tissue.
Their job is to support and protect the body. Even with that big job, there are only three main components, and these are the fibers, both elastic and collagenous, as well as ground substance and cells.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
Since we started this show saying that we would talk about the histology of the body, we must tell you that connective tissue is made up of three types of cells called fibroblasts, adipocytes, and immune cells that include the macrophages, mast cells, and plasma cells.
Each one of these would take a show to fully describe, but we would probably lose 99% of the audience if we did that. Instead, Carmen and I are only going to tell you the most important and interesting things about these cells in particular. For a one-sentence resume of these cells, we have
fibroblasts, which are the least specialized of all the cells that are mainly responsible for secreting the non-rigid extracellular matrix that includes the fibers called collagen, elastin, and fibronectin. While the adipocytes are fat-storing cells are thought to derive from fibroblastic-like cells, leaving the macrophages, mast cells, and plasma cells to round out the pack of connective tissue cells.
I could do that backwards, but it would sound something like this.
That wasn't that funny. Anyway, there are three types of cartilage. Most people have heard of cartilage. As a matter of fact, I have heard some patients tell me that they were diagnosed with a torn cartilage, most often in the knee.
You see, cartilage comes in three flavors: hyaline, fiber, and elastic. You find the hyaline cartilage in the ribs, the nose, larynx, and trachea, while fibrocartilage is the more well-known type, as it's found in the intervertebral discs, the joint capsules, and the ligaments. The last type is the elastic cartilage, found in the external ear, epiglottis, and larynx. Mary, Mary, quite contrary. How does your cartilage grow? With blood far away, it might take all day for nutrients and oxygen to reach. Not the greatest nursery rhyme, was it? But you get the idea.
Unlike other connective tissue, cartilage is avascular. In other words, it has no blood vessels within it. So cartilage gets its nourishment by long-range diffusion from nearby capillaries in the perichondrium.
Therefore, cartilage can never become very thick, as diffusion would not be sufficient to supply the cartilage with its needed nutrients and oxygen. Now, this is in contrast to bone, because bone has a very good blood supply.
So how does cartilage grow at all? Well, there are two ways. First, by interstitial growth, where cells called chondrocytes grow and divide and lay down more matrix inside the existing cartilage.
Now, this mainly happens during childhood and adolescence. But what about later on or with cartilage damage? Well, growth and repair are very slow, if at all. In this case, there is what is called appositional growth.
Here, new surface layer of matrix are added to the pre-existing matrix by new chondroblasts from the perichondrium.
Unlike the articular hyaline cartilage and fibrocartilage do not have a perichondrium. Finally, we have bone. Luckily, most bone has enough blood supply to heal pretty easily. Bone is strong, flexible, and semi-rigid. It can withstand compression forces, and yet it can still bend, at least to some degree.
Like cartilage and other types of connective tissue, bone is made up of cells and extracellular matrix. Cells in bone are called osteocytes and osteoblasts.
There are also two other cell types called osteoprogenitor cells and osteoclasts. And while we're at this, there are also two types of mature bone. Compact bone, which is found in the shafts of long bones, like the femur or the tibia. This type of bone makes up 80% of all bone. And then there's spongy bone, which is found at the ends of long bones. This type of bone contains red bone marrow and a network of bony trabeculae.
A periosteum, or covering, is found on the outside of bone. It is pretty dense and fibrous. It is in this layer that the muscles insert.
The endosteum is the name given to the tissue that lines the inner surfaces of bones. Now, unlike cartilage, bone has a very good blood supply. Bone is riddled with blood capillaries. The central cavity contains blood vessels and is a storage for bone marrow.
All of the osteocytes in bone are within 0.2 millimeter of a capillary, which is equivalent to about 7/1000ths of an inch.
Just like cartilage, there are two ways in which a bone can grow. Bone can form onto a temporary cartilage scaffold, or bone can form directly onto fibrous connective tissue. So what happens when you break a bone? Well, first, it depends on what type of bone break it is.
A bone fracture can be either open or closed. It is considered closed if the fracture did not break through the skin. An open, when also called a compound fracture, did break through the skin.
Then there is the partial or complete fracture. In partial breaks, the fracture line did not go through the bone. There's one more way to define a fracture. It could be displaced or non-displaced. If the broken pieces still line up, it's a non-displaced break. If they don't, well, then it's displaced.
There are also different types of fractures, such as transverse, where the break is straight across the bone, oblique, where the fracture line is at an angle across the bone.
The break may be considered a stress fracture if it's very thin, and this is sometimes called a hairline fracture. Also, green stick fractures break on one side and bend on the other. In comminuted fractures, the bone breaks into three or more fragments.
There are other types called the compression fractures, which often happen in the spine, spiral fractures, and avulsion fractures, when a tendon or ligament pulls off a piece of bone.
Getting back to what happens when a bone breaks. Bone repair begins within just a few hours of the injury. You get a healthy swelling around the break as a blood clot starts to form. At the same time, the immune system sends in cells that act kind of like trash collectors to get rid of the small bone pieces and kill any germs. Also, blood vessels go into the area to help the healing process. This step may really last a week or two.
Later, you get a soft callus around the broken bone when collagen moves in and it slowly replaces the blood clot.
About 2 weeks after the break, cells called osteoblasts move in and get to work. They form new bone, adding minerals to the mix to make the bone hard.
Bone remodeling starts with when osteoclasts break down any extra bone that formed during healing so your bones get back to their regular shape.
And that final step may actually continue long after you feel better, sometimes lasting up to 9 years. Yes, I said years, 9 years. Now, before we end the show, I just thought of something that you might want to remember, especially if you're trying to lose weight. One cookie generally contains around 140 calories. A 1 mile walk for a 150-pound person burns around 100 calories. So to burn off one cookie, you need to walk around 30 blocks or a mile and a half. So think about that before you eat that dessert.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma,